When I came in, if he had anything in mind that he thought might be a good theme for the week, and he suggested that, so that's what we're going to do. But if you'll please turn to Genesis chapter 12, I want to read concerning the Abrahamic covenant, the contract, or the what we would call today the treaty that God drew up with Abraham. We need to remember that there is only one nation on this earth with which God has a treaty arrangement. That nation is the nation of Israel. God has never signed a treaty with the British Empire, never signed a treaty with the United States of America. But he has signed a treaty with the nation of Israel. And the terms of the treaty are very clear. They're spelled out in three major passages in the book of Genesis. Verse 1, chapter 12. Now the Lord had said unto Abraham, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And this is the verse that touches every other nation under heaven. I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now, Abraham was God's friend. We don't usually think of God needing friends, but he delights to call Abraham his friend. I've often thought of God watching Abraham as he pursued his pilgrimage down here. From time to time, looking down upon him, he'd say to the angels, he'd say to Gabriel, he'd say to Michael, hey, you see that old man down there? You see him? That old man down there with a stick? That's my friend. He's my friend. Many of us are, I'm sure all of us here this morning are God's children. I wonder how many of us are God's friends. And you know, when you have a friend, you keep on visiting him. You can't stay away. If he's your friend, you visit your friend. And you'll discover in the book of Genesis, God's always popping down here to earth to have a little visit with his friend. When you come to chapter 15, you find God's visiting Abraham a second time. And he enters into a very solemn now contractual arrangement with Abraham. And he signed the contract, or the covenant, or the treaty, in the way that a treaty was signed in those days, by sacrifice. They took the sacrifice, and they split it in half, and they arranged the pieces. And then the contracting parties to the agreement walked up and down together between the pieces of the sacrifice. Very solemn and significant and vivid way to sign a contract in those days. And God tells Abraham, now I'm going to sign this contract, now I'm going to put you to sleep, because this is going to be a one-sided contract. I'm going to do everything. You're just going to get all the goods. I'm going to do everything. Now you go to sleep, Abraham, and I'll sign this contract. A deep sleep fell upon Abraham, and he tells him that he is going to do certain things, that his seed are going down to another country. They'll be there for four generations, 400 years. If you want to know how long a generation is in the Bible, that might give you some clue, although it's still an elastic expression. In the fourth generation, he says, verse 16, they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not full. Verse 18, the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land. Up until this point, all God always said, I will give, I will give. Now he says, I have given. From the river of Egypt unto the great river Euphrates. That, I take it, that's from the Nile to the Euphrates. In other words, all the territory that the Arabs claim today is deeded to Abraham and to his seed. The Arabs are there only on sufferance. That territory does not belong to them, any of it. It belongs to Abraham and to his seed, from the river of Egypt unto the great, great river, the river Euphrates. Then you come to chapter 17, God comes down again and underlines a specific clause in this covenant as to which of Abraham's sons he had in mind when he talked about the seed. Now, Abraham had Ishmael, from whom came the Arabs. That was the child of the flesh. But he was going to have another child. And verse 19, God said, Sarah, thy wife, shall bear a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him. For everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. As for Ishmael, I've heard thee. He says, I'll do this and that and the other. But he says, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. I want to talk this morning briefly about the events that led up to the rebirth of the state of Israel. The dream of a repatriation of the scattered Jewish people to their own homeland in Palestine began with a man called Theodor Herzl. Now, Theodor Herzl was an Austrian Jew. He was a journalist. He had considered for a number of years the dilemma of the Jewish people in Europe. He felt that there was really no future for the Jews in Europe. He was a lone voice calling in the wilderness. Nobody paid much attention to him. His idea, really, to solve the problem of the Jews in the nations of Europe was a rather interesting solution. He thought that the best thing to do would be for all Jews to become Roman Catholics. In fact, he actually approached the Pope and entered into discussions with the Vatican how he could be used to persuade European Jewry to adopt the Roman Catholic faith and thus become permanently assimilated into European life and society. And he seriously pursued this for a while, thinking that this was the best way to end the centuries-long persecution of Jewish people in Europe. It was for all Jews to assimilate and become Roman Catholics. Then came the Dreyfus trial. Dreyfus was a French Jewish officer in the French army. He was falsely accused of high treason. He was given a trial. He was found guilty. And he was put in the French Alcatraz, stripped of all his military honors and his uniform, disgraced and incarcerated. And he was innocent. It was an anti-Semitic plot. It took many years before he was exonerated and reinstated into the French army. But the Dreyfus trial resulted in surges of anti-Semitic outbursts in France. Now that changed Theodor Herzl's mind. He decided that there was no future at all for the Jew in Europe, whether he assimilated or not. And he decided that the only thing that could be done was to restore the Jews to their ancestral home of Palestine. And he founded the Zionist movement, which was an atheistic, agnostic movement. He had no concept whatsoever of God or of the Bible. He had no intention in any way whatsoever, any shape or form, of fulfilling Bible prophecy. Didn't believe the Bible. He was a thoroughly secular Jew. Didn't believe in God. He just decided that what was needed was a secular state. Zionism is atheistic and agnostic in its approach. It doesn't pretend in any way to be attempting to fulfill Bible prophecy. The nation had to be reconstituted in unbelief, as we mentioned on Sunday morning, and so it was. when he began to suggest to Jews that they should begin a movement to get back to the land of Palestine, he was met with universal scorn. Most Jews thought he was a bit of a nut. They were not interested. Like the Babylonian Jews, they were too comfortable where they were. They had no interest in pioneering in Palestine. And so his trumpet call fell mostly on deaf ears. But there were some, and the Zionist movement was born, and a trickle of Jews began to return to a country that at that time was under the control of the Turks. The Turks had held the country for several centuries, had no interest in the country. They had largely depopulated the country. They had cut down all the trees in the country. They turned the land into a desert, and it was just decaying there in a little corner of the Mediterranean of no interest to anybody, not even to the Turks who owned the country at that time. Not very much happened until there was an outbreak of persecution in Eastern Europe against the Jews, and that sparked a surge of interest amongst East European Jews in Theodor Herzl's idea of a national home for the Jew in Palestine. And they began to come back. They were pioneers in every sense of the word. They drained marshes. They reclaimed land that had been allowed to return to rocks and rubble into fertile farms. Began to come back. But again, there was not a great deal of interest in the movement amongst the Jews until the First World War. And when the First World War broke out, Britain all of a sudden discovered that she had her back to the wall. She had a world empire in those days. She was locked in a life and death struggle with Germany. And all of a sudden she discovered that she had run out of cordite for the manufacture of gunpowder. And to all practical purposes, the war was lost. You can't fight a major world war without gunpowder, not in those days. In desperation, the British government appealed to a Jewish chemist by the name of Chaim Weizmann. And they asked Mr. Weizmann if he could find a synthetic substitute for cordite. And could he please do it quickly? He discovered a method of manufacturing what was needed out of horse chestnuts. If you've ever been to Britain, you know that the horse chestnut is a big tree like an oak tree. It grows wild and profusely everywhere in Britain. And it was a very, very available substance. And one man, a Jew, by the name of Chaim Weizmann, actually saved the British Empire from defeat and dissolution. A grateful British government asked Mr. Weizmann what he would like by way of recognition. Now, Chaim Weizmann was a Zionist. He believed in the Zionist cause. He believed that the Jews needed a home, a country of their own. They needed Palestine. They needed to go back to the land of their fathers, that the land rightfully belonged to them, and that it had been deeded to them, and it was theirs, and there wasn't much of a population there anyway. There was nothing there. Nobody wanted the country. Weizmann had espoused Herzl's great rallying cry, "There is a land without a people. There is a people without a land. Give the land without a people to the people without a land." And when the British government asked Chaim Weizmann what he would like by way of recognition, he said, "Nothing for myself, but recognition for my people." And he asked the British government to espouse the Zionist cause officially and to lend its influence and power in the world to establishing a national home for the Jew in Palestine once the war was over. The British government issued a very famous document known as the Balfour Declaration, in which His Majesty's government pledged itself after the war to establish a national home for the Jew in Palestine. As the war came towards its end, General Lord Allenby led the victorious British troops up into Palestine. And, of course, the Turks had sided with the Germans during the First World War, and they were the enemies of the Western powers. And when British troops came rolling into Palestine, they rolled up outworn and no longer wanted Turkish misrule of the whole area, like a worn-out Turkish carpet. And so as the prize of war, Palestine now fell into British hands. The League of Nations then ratified Britain's territorial claims to Palestine. And they issued what was known as a mandate. And under the terms of the mandate, the British Empire was deeded Palestine. Those were the days of Western imperialism, of course, you understand that. Now we're in the days of Russian imperialism. Those were the days of Western imperialism, and after the First World War, the spoils of war were just carved up between the various victorious powers. Britain got Palestine, and France got Lebanon and Syria, I think, and one way or another. But anyway, the country of Palestine fell into the hands of Britain. And the League of Nations issued a mandate in which it authorized, on behalf of the nations of the world, it authorized the British government to establish a national home for the Jew in Palestine, giving regard to the rights of whatever Arabs were in the country at the time. The British, having received this mandate from the League of Nations, proceeded with the task of establishing a home for the Jew in Palestine. They were quite pragmatic about it. They looked at the situation and they discovered that the country that had been entrusted to them under the mandate, known as Palestine, comprised territory on both sides of the Jordan. It was the old Bible Palestine, and it was both sides of the River Jordan. And with a great deal of pragmatism, they decided that what they would do is divide the country into two sections. On the east bank of the Jordan, they would establish a national home for the Arabs, so that any Arabs in the country that didn't like what was happening could resettle on the east bank of the country. And they brought into existence a country that had never existed before. Was called Transjordan in those days. We now call it just simply Jordan. Prior to the First World War, there was no such country. It was all part of Palestine. The claims of the Palestinian Arabs are, of course, made in defiance of the facts, really. The British created a new country that was to be called Jordan, and that was to be the Arab part of the country. And on the west bank of the Jordan, they intended to establish a national home for the Jew. If the Arabs didn't want to leave, they could stay there. And they would be given autonomy, and they would be given fair treatment under the law, but the fact remained that they were going to build a national home for the Jew on the west bank of the Jordan. And for a while, things went well. Immigration began to pick up. The British went about building railways and roads and instituting democratic form of government in the country, and building schools and doing all the things that they did in all the other colonial territories to prepare the country eventually for independence. But in the early 30s, the Arabs began to react against the increasing immigration of Jews into the country, and there were a series of uprisings in the country, terrorist activities by the Arabs against the Jews and against the British. This went on for several years, and then it became increasingly obvious that a new star had arisen in Europe, and a very ominous star, a man by the name of Adolf Schicklgruber, otherwise known to history as Adolf Hitler, had surfaced in Germany. He had written a book called Mein Kampf, in which he had announced his intentions, and in which he had stated that the ultimate solution to what he called the Jewish question, that there was only one solution, he called it the final solution, and that was to exterminate European Jewry. He made that perfectly clear. And it was becoming increasingly clear also that Germany was rearming and preparing for war. Moreover, the Germans were intriguing with the Arabs. Germans hated Jews, and the Arabs hated Jews. In those days, if you go back and look at your map and your history book, you will discover that most of these countries in the Middle East were ruled from London, all part of the British Empire. Egypt, Sudan, Palestine, Jordan, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, all that part of the world was ruled from London. Saudi Arabia, all the Arab Emirates, were all under the control of the British government in those days. And of course these were lands of vital interest to the British, because this was where their oil came from. And when they discovered that the Germans were now intriguing with the Arabs, because of the existence of the State of Israel and the British Balfour Declaration that allowed unlimited Jewish immigration into Palestine, there was consternation in high quarters, and it was decided that the best thing to do was put a stop to further Jewish immigration into Palestine. That would placate the Arabs, and it would defuse this situation. And so the British issued an infamous document known as the White Paper. The White Paper was a betrayal of Britain's pledge and the trust that had been placed in her by the League of Nations. Because by the terms of the White Paper, the British government effectually stopped any further significant immigration of Jews into Palestine. The timing was dreadful. It was at the time when Hitler was coming to power in Germany, when many European Jews were already being persecuted in Germany, when it was dawning on them that Theodor Herzl was absolutely right, there was no future for them in Europe. And just at the time when, of all the times in history, right on the very eve of the Holocaust, the Jews needed a place to go, Britain slammed the door. And she said, "You're not coming here." I believe with all my heart that God said, "I won't forget that." And he didn't. After the war, it just took about 10 years for God to strip Britain of her empire and leave her as a bankrupt island off the coast of Europe. But just at this critical juncture in Jewish history, when more than any other time they needed a place to go, Britain slammed the door. Mind you, the other countries of the world were no better. They all more or less slammed the door to immigration. The United States wasn't any better. You people over here didn't want Jews any more than Britain wanted them in Palestine. And so the Second World War burst upon the world with the Holocaust. When the truth was finally known, as the Allied army swept into these horror camps of the Nazis, into Auschwitz and Belsen, Ravensbrück, all the rest of them, Treblinka, with about 20 or 30 of them altogether, hellholes. People who went in there came away shaken and haunted for the rest of their lives by what they see. I was just talking just a few days ago, just before I came down here, to a man who went into Belsen right after it was opened. Still haunts him what he saw. Corpses stacked up like cordwood. The stench of death in the air. The Allies decided that they had to bring the perpetrators of this outrage to justice. I mean, justice wasn't done at Nuremberg. Nobody who knows the full history pretends that it was. For one reason, the Russians were just as guilty of atrocities as the Germans, but nobody attempted to bring the Russians to account. The whole thing was rather hypocritical, but at least it was some effort to expose to the world what had actually happened. One man by the name of Colonel Hoss, who had been a commandant at Auschwitz, made no bones about it. He, in a matter-of-fact way, described how he had personally supervised the extermination of 2 million people. When he was questioned, I read a book some years ago about called Nuremberg Diary by a man named Gilbert, who was the prison psychologist at Nuremberg, had free access to all the prisons. He talked to all of them. He talked to Göring and to Ribbentrop and Frank, the butcher of Poland, and all the rest of them. He had a long personal interview with the colonel who ran the camp at Auschwitz. As a psychologist, trying to find out what made a man like that tick. He described how, in matter-of-fact terms, he made no attempt whatsoever to deny the enormity of the crime that had been committed. He said the problem wasn't killing Jews. He said that was easy. He said they even cooperated with their own extermination. He said the problem was getting rid of the body. When the truth dawned upon the world what had happened, the surviving members of the Jewish people in Europe began to flock back in great numbers to the only country in the world to which they had any right or any claim. I was in Palestine in the British Army during those days, and I stood there as a young soldier, watching my country betray its trust. The Zionists would organize the refugees. They brought them to the southern ports of Europe. They were getting any old crate that would make one voyage down the Mediterranean. I saw a number of those ships tied up on Haifa Key and on the breakwater at Haifa. One of them called the Exodus. You read the story of the Exodus by Leon Uris, if you can stomach his dreadful things he says about Christ in that book. But the actual history actually happened. I saw parts of it. Saw the survivors. When the British still had the white paper in place, they hadn't repealed the white paper, they had still very much restricted Jewish immigration into Palestine. There was a civil war going on in the country. The Arabs and the Jews now were both operating terrorist organizations in the country. Mr. Begin, who was the previous Prime Minister of the State of Israel, when I was a soldier in Palestine, he was a terrorist. He was the head of a group known as the Irgun's Vileoni. And the British had a price of £30,000 on his head. They were just plain outright terrorists. They did everything that the Palestinian PLO does. They did those kind of things themselves. Remember once some soldiers had been kidnapped by the Irgun because the British had condemned a couple of Jewish terrorists to death. And when the British went ahead and executed the Jewish terrorists, Fagan's crowd not only executed the soldiers that they had taken as reprisal, but they booby-trapped their bodies. So that when the bodies were cut down, they exploded. I mean, let's not whitewash the situation. The situation is very bad. But Britain had brought a lot of this on herself. And I remember as a soldier standing there many a time on Haifa docks watching as the immigrant ships, illegal immigrant ships they were called, stood off the port of Haifa on their way in. They had been intercepted 3 miles out by a British gunboat. The captain had been arrested. The ship was brought into Haifa docks. They cleared the docks of all civilians. They took the Jews off those boats. And you saw suffering humanity. You saw men and women, boys and girls who survived a living hell. Written all over them. They took them off those ships. They sprayed them with DDT. Get rid of the life. And then they put them down in the hold on a British cargo vessel like so much cattle. Now they were under the British flag. And they shipped them back out to sea. They took them to the island of Cyprus, which in those days was the British territory, and they put them back behind barbed wire. God said, I won't forget that. I won't forget that. Well, you know what happened. Eventually, the League of Nations decided that this Palestine problem, as it was called, had to be solved. Britain had decided to terminate the mandate and dump the problem in the hands of the United Nations and pull out. They decided to partition the country. Now, they'd already partitioned, the British had already partitioned it once. They decided to partition what was left again, and they drew an absolutely ridiculous map, patchwork quilt of territory, some Jewish, some Arab. And they had a vote on it in the United Nations. The Jews didn't think they had a chance in the world of getting United Nations endorsement. The partition of Palestine. They needed 22 votes just to offset the Arab votes in the United Nations. Besides, both Russia and the United States had to endorse this thing, that it was to become legal. And the United States and Russia had never voted on an issue with the United Nations ever. Never voted on the same side ever. It wasn't likely that they would on this issue. But for a variety of reasons that seemed to make good sense to the men in the Kremlin, they decided to vote for partition. The United States voted for partition. And right down to the very end, the issue hung right in the balance. Some voted for, some voted against, and some remained neutral. It's interesting to me that the only country, the Arabs, were able to persuade. Now, they coerced a number of countries into voting for them, but the only country they were actually able to persuade that the Jews had no right to be in Palestine was Cuba. You know what happened to Cuba? God said, I won't forget that. Interesting. And so the United Nations voted to establish a national home for the Jew in Palestine. And there they are. They changed the name of the country to Israel. They've taken Jerusalem as their capital. And as for the rest of the story, if you listen to that famous commentator, you have to buy a book called Exploring the World of the Jew, now sold out, but if you go into the bookstore, they'll take orders for it. You'll find it is indeed a fascinating story. The hand of God in history. We have arrived at that point in history where God is going to move again directly in the affairs of men. I believe that with all my heart. One morning this week I intend to take up, or mention in passing, if nothing else, at least 22 different things that are happening in the world today that indicate that our generation is probably, perhaps more than probably, the terminal generation. Now, if it was just one thing, we might write it off. But everywhere we look today, there is cumulative evidence that we have arrived at the last day. Well, I'm sorry, I've got to quit now and let you get down to other things. And I'll just close the word of prayer and thank you for being so attentive. Father, we thank you this morning for your goodness to your ancient people Israel. Your hand has been upon their history. You have kept them from extermination and from assimilation. And you preserve them and you have a future for them. But as Paul says, blindness in part has happened to Israel. And our heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is they might be saved. And that you'll work amongst this thine ancient people and bring many to a saving knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. We ask these things in our Savior's name.